shall not cause harm to any vehicle nor the personal contents thereof, nor through inaction let that vehicle or the personal contents thereof come to harm. It's what I call the repo code, kid.
Truly radical filmmakers are few and far between, especially working in America in the modern era. But Alex Cox is definitely a radical filmmaker. Born in Liverpool, he originally studied law at Oxford in the early 1970s, but switched to studying radio, film, and TV at Bristol University. He then moved to Los Angeles to attend film school at UCLA. He has been called British cinema's oldest enfant terrible, but his first films were made in America. First the short film Edge City while at UCLA, and then the cult classic Repo Man, envisioned as a film school project with a budget of $70,000. Repo Man has been hailed as one of the first truly modern independent films, a decade before the independent film gold rush of the 1990s. Alex wrote the screenplay, directed, made a cameo, and produced it with Edge City Productions, a film production company started by Alex and his UCLA friends. Michael Nesmith of the Monkees got involved as an executive producer, allowing for a budget of $1.5 million and a deal with Universal. An interesting mix of big names and Alex's collaborators were cast in Repo Man. Emilio Estevez was brought on board as a billable name for the studio, Harry Dean Stanton, Olivia Barash, Cy Richardson, Tracy Walter, and future collaborators of Alex's like Dick Rude and Xander Schloss.
You know the way everybody's into weirdness right now? Books in all the supermarkets about Bermuda triangles, UFOs, how the Mayans invented television, that kind of thing.
I don't read them books.
Well, the way I see it, it's exactly the same. There ain't no difference between a flying saucer and a time machine.
The film was shot by the Dutch cinematographer Robbie Muller as he awaited production to start on Wim Wenders' Paris, Texas. Repo Man's soundtrack took from the punk scene in California at the time, including Black Flag, Suicidal Tendencies, and the Circle Jerks, who make an appearance as a lounge band. And after Iggy Pop's manager viewed the film, he even volunteered a title song for the film. Alex's reputation took off after Repo Man became a classic of Reagan-era dystopia. His next film, Sid and Nancy, originally called Love Kills, was a biopic about the relationship between Sid Vicious and Nancy Spungen, starring a young Gary Oldman and Chloe Webb. The film had a soundtrack composed by Joe Strummer, Pray for Rain, and The Pogues. It was about mutual destruction that was wrought by a drug-fueled relationship. The ways that heroin destroyed not only Sid and Nancy's lives, but the wider British anarchist movement and the left of the 1970s in general, and featured a Vietnam vet played by Cy Richardson, making the point that Sid Vicious could have been selling healthy anarchy, but allowed Smack to control him.
You guys got no right to be strung out on that stuff. You could be selling healthy anarchy. But long as you're addicts, you'd be full of shit.
Next, Alex helmed two projects. First, the movie Straight to Hell, featuring an insane array of musical guests and frequent collaborators, Xander Berkeley, Xander Schloss, Joe Strummer, Cy Richardson, Jane McGowan of The Pogues, Dick Rude, Dennis Hopper, Jim Jarmusch, Elvis Costello, Courtney Love, Grace Jones. This film features one of my favorite scenes in any Alex Cox film, where this huge array of musical luminaries and famous character actors point guns at Xander Schloss and make him sing his wiener song.
Let's make that wiener kid sing his song. Wanna?
In a Western parody, which was actually used to help finance a trip to film the movie Walker starring Ed Harris in war-torn Nicaragua in the midst of the Sandinista-Contra War, a shot across the bow of American imperialism during the Reagan administration, directly comparing Walker's famous filibuster to the modern funding of the Contra terrorists. Cox even had Sandinistas work on the film. This was a bridge too far for a Hollywood that has always worked hand in glove with American imperialism. And Alex was blacklisted, excoriated in the press, and has not been able to work with Hollywood studios since. Alex moved to working in Mexico, releasing the film Highway Patrolman in 1991. At the time, the film was given an extremely limited distribution in the U.S., despite some critics hailing it as his best film. And was invited by the BBC to direct an adaptation of Jorge Luis Borges' Death and the Compass in 1992. Alex Cox has since been working in micro-budget filmmaking, crowdfunding films, as we're going to talk about tonight, and often using budgets of less than $100,000. Searchers 2.0, Repo Chick, Build a Galactic Hero, and Tombstone Rashomon have all been funded this way. In 1988, Alex also hosted the BBC show Moviedrome, introducing 141 films between 1988 and 1994. a resource that I have definitely used early on in this podcast, as many of the episodes and intros are now available on YouTube.
Ed Harris's performance is contained, fixated, and charismatic enough to make sense of Walker's constant switching along the spectrum from liberator to dictator. Cox's direction does a lot of switching of its own, along the spectrum from Peckinpah Westerns to the apocalyptic scenarios of Jodorowsky and the visionary excesses of Herzog. Closer to home, Walker may have been intended as a political cut-up on Lester lines, but unfortunately came out as carry-on Contras.
Yeah!
Alex has also been a prolific writer with books including X Films, True Confessions of a Radical Filmmaker, 10,000 Ways to Die, A Director's Take on the Spaghetti Western, and Alex Cox's Introduction to Film, A Director's Perspective, among many others, and has been a professor at the University of Colorado Boulder. Tonight we're talking to Alex about his last film, a Western version of Nikolai Gogol's Dead Souls, which he is currently fundraising for on Kickstarter. Link for the Kickstarter campaign, which ends on July 26, is in the description, as well as his career, filmmaking style, the soundtracks he's used, and his work in the punk scene, and the state of filmmaking today. Anyway, before I introduce the panel, please like this video and subscribe to the Movie Night Extravaganza YouTube channel. Hit that bell to get notified whenever we're streaming. Also, we are now monetized, so if you have any pressing questions during this live stream, send us a super chat, which helps me keep the show running and which I am obligated by international law, human rights law, to answer. We also have a Patreon, patreon.com/movienightextra. All of our after parties are on there forever. We also have a new Discord and a Letterboxd HQ account, so those are two more places to follow along with us. Links are in the description. Okay, let me introduce the panel. Conan Neutron, host of Britonic Reversal, co-host of Movie Night Extravaganza, and frontman for Conan Neutron and the Secret Friends, neutronfriends.bandcamp.com. Jay Underworld, illustrator, book cover artist, artist for Give Them an Argument, co-host for Movie Night Extravaganza, and Bad Takes. KT Baldessaro is an actress, director, and writer who wrote and co-directed and also starred in Girl in the Basement, along with appearing in quite a few horror movies. You can also catch her voice acting in a scripted podcast series, The Starwell Foundation, an audio drama set in the City of Superheroes, wherever podcasts are listened to, and new film podcast, What If I Don't Like It, episodes bi-monthly, as well as on TikTok at Movie Runtime. J.G. Michael, host of Parallax Views, a podcast where politics, history, and culture are examined from perspectives you may not have considered before. Alex Cox is the director of Repo Man, Sid and Nancy, Straight to Hell, Walker, and the subject of this intro. I, of course, am your host and one of the last people to follow the Repo Code in 2024, Forrest Miller. I shall not cause harm to any vehicle, nor the personal contents thereof, nor through an action let that vehicle or the personal contents thereof come to harm.
Fantastic. Alex Cox, welcome to the show, man. So great to have you.
Thank you very much.
It's an honor to have you.
It's an honor for me to be here too, and especially to watch all of that. Boy, that was a lot of information.
Yeah, my usual joke is well, that's all the time we got, folks. Let's see you later. See you next time after the intro. But Forrest puts a lot of work into this.
Yeah, well, I mean, usually it's just one movie. In this case, you know, it was Alex's entire career that I was trying to distill into something that then I could, you know, plug the fundraiser at the end.
A good amount have been covered on this show too.
Yes, yes, yes. No, very good. Thank you very much.
And I should say, say it again, the fundraiser for your last film is in the description of this episode. So if people want to check that out, it's literally, you know, it's like us talking about stuff and then it's the fundraiser. So everyone should, in fact, check that out.
29th. It runs until the 29th of the month, not until the 26th. You actually have 3 extra days.
Oh, wow.
All right. Well, we got to start over to the intro from the beginning now. So
I got to mute it where it says 26 and say 29 and then
yeah, exactly. Which you could just do like what they did with the Repo Man TV edit, where all the expletives are just the most ridiculous things possible. How did that come to pass, Alice? Because I use that and the Big Lebowski are my hallmarks for this is how you do a TV edit to make it like more hilarious than it was even in the first place.
All of the weird language was done by Dick Rude, because he and I had been, I wouldn't say hired because we didn't get paid, but we were asked by Universal, even though they didn't like the film very much, didn't like us very much, to come back anyway because they wanted to prepare a TV safe version. And by the time we cut out all the swearing and all the drug taking, the film was very short. And of course, they asked us to come back in, go into the outtakes, and produce a new version, which wouldn't give offense to anyone. And so one of the things that Dick did was to come up with terms like melon farmers and then direct the actors to use these new and exciting phrases.
It reminds me of one of my favorite movies of all time is Terry Gilliam's Brazil. And they made a movie like for TV that they made an edit of it that was like had a happy ending. And I'm like, that's not what the movie, like, that's insane. And I watched it once, exactly once, just to say that I watch it. And it was like, I would be mad beyond belief, as I'm sure Terry Gilliam was, that they would do something along those lines. I feel like you can't have Repo Man without the very explicit language that's happening in there. But I did agree. I did like the aesthetic effect of, okay, well, let's do the weirdest thing possible and make it like distractingly bizarre and strange, which is not how I was going to lead this off personally, but I think it's worthwhile because it is one of the weirder things of like, why would you make a clean version of this? Why? Who was that for?
Yeah, I'm wondering how we dealt with the John Wayne scene, you know, when those accusations are made about John Wayne, because now I don't think you can include things like that in the film at all, because it might give offense. But at the time, we were sort of setting out to give offense. And that was one of our offenses, you know. And I wonder how we dealt with that, or if that scene just cut out. Maybe that part of the scene just got cut out.
I feel like in a way, it was like channeling Flavor Flav and that like whole like motherfuck him and John Wayne, that like song in Fight the Power that Spike Lee uses. When they're like, I feel like that they were channeling channeling Repo Man when they did that entire like anti Elvis and anti, I mean, you'd never be anti Elvis, I'm sure, but like, you know, anti John Wayne.
I wouldn't really be anti John Wayne. I mean, I was watching Red River last night. It's a very good film, very entertaining. John Wayne's character he plays an appalling individual, a guy he wants to whip men, stuff like that, you know, which is very interesting.
Was he acting?
Even in Stagecoach, which is a fantastic film that unfortunately has some really era appropriate brown face, but he's, you know, he's good in it. It's not that he's a bad actor. It's just that, like, as a icon for conservative values and whatnot, like, you know,
yeah, for Reagan's destroyed America. I mean, essentially, right? Like, you know, that perfect image of like America, a bygone era. But I do like the idea of John Wayne in a dress, like a night slip or something, walking to the door, being like, this is how I'm comfortable, pilgrim. Like,
supposedly that was true. A guy, a lot of the stuff in Repo Man is stuff that people said to me. And there was a guy that I knew who we called Swati. And he ran a company or worked for a company called Arrow Glass and Mirror in Ocean Park in California. And he came home, or not came back to our place, where we were just hanging out drinking beer one day, and said, I was just at John Wayne's pad in Brentwood installing two-way mirrors. No way. And the guy came to the door in a dress, you know. And so even after we'd sat him down and calmed him with a little beer, you know, but even after that, he insisted that this had really happened.
It's such a perfect, though, like, encapsulation of, like, you know, masculine, I guess what they'd call now, like, a toxic masculinity, that everybody automatically jumps into the scene and goes, I like to watch my buddies fuck, too. Who doesn't? And, like, just... It's like, well, if John Wayne does it, like...
Who yeah, exactly. It must be normal, right? I love... So you mentioning that you know, large part of the dialogue, things are actually overheard. I think that's so interesting because there is such a naturalism to the dialogue. It makes sense that it would be like, oh, these are things that actual people said, maybe taken in or out of context. And there's certain things I love the tagging on, right? You know, Harry Dean Stanton saying that, you know, one sentence is the communist, the next thing, and he's like, and Christians too. And he tags it with there. That's what made it a great movie for me. Is like, oh my God, yes, please, by all means. Yeah, he doesn't want it in his car. I get it.
Along the same lines about the dialogue in these scenes, I was wondering about the UFOs are actually time machines. That's such an ingenious scene. And I was wondering, like, where you came up with that idea, because when you think about it, like, yeah, like, why wouldn't, and that's been kind of floated around in culture before, like, mm-hmm. there's ideas that, like, you know, the gods that they saw in, like, the ancient Mayans or whatever were actually, you know, people that traveled back in time to, like, give them information from the future, like, you know, that's a pretty common thing now, but it can't have been back then. Like, where did you come up with that idea?
Yeah, no, there was lots of weirdness like that, because there was, No, the Eric von Daniken books had come out before.
Chariot of the Gods?
Yes.
You know, I was going to say, there's even that one line in Carpenter's The Thing where they literally reference Chariots of the Gods.
Yeah.
So it was in the air, yeah.
Mm. It was definitely part of the culture. I mean, if you went to an alternative bookstore, I mean, you would find like the political books and you'd find the Zap comics and R. Crumb and stuff. But you'd also find, you know, a lot of Flying Saucer stuff.
I feel like with the Reagan era, there's a retreat, I guess people are retreating into the like idea of, you know, conservative Christianity, but there's also like the left had been so collapsed by that point and was like, had taken so many beatings. There's also like a weird, I guess what they call like now, like woo-woo, like spirituality to things. You know what I mean? Like, because no more is politics, like a collective thing for people. Now it's like, well, what else can we really do? And there's a lot of like, especially like left-leaning ideas about all of this weird stuff, because it's like you can no longer like kind of at the ballot or in a union or in any of these things like express your politics. And I feel like there's like a retreating of both like, you know, conservatives into this macho extra Christian facade that is the John Wayne thing, but then also on like the left liberal side, it's like, well, no, like Jane Fonda doing like workout videos, you know what I mean? Like there's like, it's like self-improvement, spirituality, and like a very woo-woo mystic side of things.
But you can't discount TV evangelists. That was huge. As someone that lived in then at that time, cannot overestimate how huge TV evangelists were as well. So the right definitely had their share of that pie. But yeah, the new age spiritual. I mean, the late night infomercial in general, right? Like whatever they were hawking, solution to all of life's problems. The only product you'll ever need.
See, now that's moved to the forefront, like in the internet age, they just hawk whatever it is just on your like Instagram feed or whatever. They're like,
yeah,
you know, it's supplements. They'll just do whatever, like, you know, whatever you need. And there's just like,
it'll make your brain bigger.
Yeah. And you've got a lot of news anchors kind of becoming televangelists. And that line is deeply blurred.
Right. Yeah.
They're influencers now, KT. That's what they are.
Yes.
Yeah. Content creators.
I make content. You sure do. Yeah,
I mean, there's a point where even like Jimmy Carter came forward as like the first evangelist, like whatever, like the first evangelical Christian born again. Yeah. And then like even Bob Dylan became like a born again. Like there's like some weird things in this right before this era where it's like these like strange kind of reversion to Christianity that you see everywhere, like across the political spectrum.
But you know, against that though, when I was teaching at UCLA, CU Boulder, a lot of the undergraduates and the graduate students that I was talking to had grown up in the sort of professional managerial class, and so they hadn't been indoctrinated with Christianity. Whereas I, as a little boy, was indoctrinated with Christianity. And although it didn't necessarily take, but it was very useful to know the paradigm, you know, because so much stuff in stories and drama and political life is based on these notions that appear in the Bible.
Mm-hmm. And mechanism for control, sure.
Oh, yeah, sure. But they do exist, and also their symbols, which are very prevalent. And so like, yeah. you know, the Trinity becomes the nuclear triad and all of that. We put our faith in a nuclear triad.
These
didn't know that. They didn't have that information because they've been brought up, agnostically.
I was rewatching Walker, which is like hands down one of my favorite movies, and it's just such a perfect encapsulation of American imperialism in Latin America in like a dose that kind of just forces you to like reckon with that. And the scene where they're storming the beaches multiple times, seeing Onward Christian Soldier, is like such right. a profound like use of that kind of Christianity, both at like in the Reagan era too, but also like it really was in the early 1900s and the 1800s. Like there's this missionary zeal to the way that American imperialism kind of everywhere in the world they were going to kind of convert people on top of all the other fucked up shit they were going to do to them, control them, and dominate, turn them into like corporate interests.
Yeah, it was colonialism, the beginning of nationless colonialism for corporate control, but really still saddled with that 1950s fetishism, right? So yeah. it makes sense. It also makes sense that, just mentioning the word, like when The Clash called that record Sandinista, that was huge. That was a very political move to like call them that, to acknowledge the Sandinistas' existence, let alone imply any sort of affiliation, Let alone cast him in the movie.
How much of the cast and crew were brought forward from the Sandinistas while making Walker?
A fair number of people in crew positions were from the Sandinistas, both in administrative and production roles, although the principal crew was from Mexico City. Because they brought the equipment with them as well, because there wasn't actually a developed film industry in Nicaragua, or there was a developing television industry. And so we worked with Sandinistas and Nicaraguans in the crew, and in the cast, there were obviously, most of the extras were either Nicaraguans or they were Americans or Europeans down there, for the revolutionary crack, And the really great part of it was not just working with them, but a guy called Roberto Lopez, who was a busy Sandinista. He was very ideological, but he worked in the government, or he worked in some local branches. And he said he wanted to have a scene where he would act and he would show how the Contras felt and why they supported American and Western European values, And so I said, okay, go ahead, we'll do it, So this was the only thing that wasn't in Rudy Wurlitz's script, was this scene that Roberto Lopez improvised, where he staggers through this battlefield weeping and he's wounded and he's shouting out, why my people, you're so stupid. Don't you realize these people came here to improve our economy, And he's yelling at the dead as they've been carried away. It's a really good scene, and just made it up. So that
the scene where they're in the middle of the battle or whatever. This might be a different scene. They're in the middle of the battle, and there's the two guys that are like, "Oh, I die for like American." They say like something that's like a line that's a lot like that, where it's like, "Oh, I die for."
Guys die a bit later. Those guys. This is an earlier battle scene when other guys die.
The historical inaccuracies, whatever that word is that I'm trying to something there. and Walker, like you have the modern newspapers, the modern magazines that are in there. Was that like a creative choice beforehand, or did some of that come through like while you were filming?
No, that was all in the script. We put it in the script deliberately. It was really Rudy's idea, I think. And he was a screenwriter, and it just seemed like that way it wouldn't be so conventional. It wouldn't just be like a story about some guy, some journalists who go down to Nicaragua and tell the story about how terrible it is. It's actually the characters. We're involved with the characters, and we're involved with the reality of it, because there are Mercedes and Newsweek and computers.
Yeah, I love that, like, the Diet Coke in there is a great, especially at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
It ramps up to that like amazing, almost Monty Python-esque beat sequence where the helicopters come down, and it's like the, you know, the helicopters that had kind of just been part of, you know, Grenada and like Vietnam, and like this, it's such a it's such an iconic scene of like, you know, those the American helicopters coming down, and it's so funny that you're thinking in your head like, yeah, this is like the 1890s and this has been ramping up to this the entire time, but it's like still like, it's surprising even knowing it's there that all of a sudden like, oh shit, like it's the American military storming the beaches again. And then they're like, you know, Walker the whole time has been making the speeches about like, oh, I am a Nicaraguan. I'm like the president. And then they're like, yeah, you're not coming onto the thing. Like, and then they just they fly everybody else away.
I'm sorry. I can't believe that guy just improvised that particular speech. As a screenwriter, do you usually like it when people improvise? I mean, that really worked out very well.
No, I think if actors are inclined to do it, they often do quite well. I mean, in Repo Man, the whole Repo Code thing was sort of invented by Harry Dean Stanton, because he took bits of the script and pulled them all together in that one speech.
That's incredible.
So I think,
wow.
Yeah, when actors do that, I mean, it's a bit of a stretch, because sometimes when an actor says, especially a guy who isn't necessarily a professional actor, but a local government functionary, but he says, I would like to do a scene which I demonstrate the, you know, he did. That was the amazing thing, was he had the capacity, he really felt he could do it, and he did. And it's a great dramatic scene.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, and part of that, I suppose, is like just trusting the people you're working with, right? And being a bit of a level check on it. Like sometimes people need to be corralled and sometimes they need to be let off the leash, so to speak, right?
Yeah. And I know that there are some directors that just won't allow it at all.
Oh, yeah. David Mamet, you know.
He really was a writer who much later became a director, wasn't he?
Yeah.
For him, the script is much more important than the actors.
Yeah, I was going to say, these pesky actors are just getting in the way, screwing up his dialogue. I mean,
they might not say fuck enough times.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Then we wouldn't even have a movie.
It's surprising something like Repo Man, though, that Harry Dean Stanton was you know, had the foresight to do that into an entire, like, into an entire speech that distills those ideas down. Like, in Walker,
Like an iconic one that sort of like transcends the movie itself, right? Like, sorry to interrupt, Force, but like I feel like it became an important part of punk rock culture somehow. And I say that as someone that, you know, came up punk, you know, underneath all these spangles, I'm a punk rocker at heart. And like the whole, there was something, even though the actual profession of being a repo man, there's nothing punk rock about it. Like the idea, the ethos, be like the, you know, sort of,
what's closer to being a cop than being a punk? Like, in some
but
way.
but it was fashioned in terms of like nihilism and sort of alternate modes of living, and done in such a way that wasn't like, hey, look at these cool guys doing cool guy stuff. It was like, no, these guys are scumbags, and like they're doing scumbag stuff, and it's not that much of a fall.
Scumbags in a world of scumbags, which kind of makes it perfect, because like this 1984 dystopia where it's, you know, everything is kind of happening. Right. Breakneck speed, and they just kind of allow people to fucking drag race and like crazy parts of the underpasses and stuff, like so many just crazy scenes in that. And so it's like in this crazy world where everybody seems like a scumbag, like there's not one character in this that feels like, even his even Emilio Estevez's girlfriend like tortures him, you know, in that one
right scene. She totally does, exactly, she's culpable too.
Mm-hmm. And like I mean, Stanton was a great choice for the lead, but I've never seen him really in many other lead choices. Like, was that your decision? Did he just really embody the role?
Yeah, no, definitely. He was the right guy. I mean, we were talking to another actor. We were talking to Dennis Hopper about playing the part. But and Dennis, and I thought he would be very good, but Dennis's agent wanted more money than was in the budget. So then a friend of mine told me that she had just gone to a party where, and she said there was this guy that she had met at the party who had this Old West skeleton-y thing going on, which would be perfect for Repo Man. And I said, you must be Harry Dean Stanton! You know, he's already a big fan of Harry Dean. And so it was fated to be him. You
know, but he had never been a lead before in a movie, right? Like, he'd been more of a that guy character actor.
That's
and
right.
A good one.
After this film, He then got his second lead because Wim Wenders was originally going to have Dean Stockwell be the lead guy in Paris, Texas. But Robbie Mueller, the cameraman, called him in Germany and said, you know, you're going to come out in a month or so to start to get ready for Paris, Texas. You better meet this guy, Harry Dean Stanton. And so it was Robbie's introduction.
Yeah, that's amazing. Because I was going to ask about the timeline on that, because it's like you guys got Robbie Mueller when he's literally waiting in a hotel for Wim Wenders to get back to him, right? Like, he was kind of waiting in America for like maybe like one of the first times.
He'd done a film in the United States before, and he lived in Germany. And when we spoke to him, I think he was in Germany. But I know that Paris, Texas was coming up. I know that he was planning to go and do it. And it just worked out that our schedule, we were about 2 months before the shooting of Paris, Texas. And so, you know, he had some time off, went back home, came back to the States again. And I remember that just when we were finishing Repo Man, I met Wim Wenders because he'd turned up and he'd bought like a pickup truck with a camper on the back. The American road movie, you know.
I was going to say, he's going to be a Kings of the Road himself.
Yeah, yeah. He bought his Kings of the Road mobile. He was right out to Texas.
Nobody does greens like that guy. Like, nobody. Like, he does green like no other cinematographer, including Deacons, frankly. Like,
and it's always this natural lighting. It's like hyper-saturated natural lighting that it comes out of. It seems like.
And I think it gave Repo Man a very unique look, much like Paris, Texas. When we did Paris, Texas, we talked about the look of the film, right? Like the look and how much it established mood and helped along, you know, especially scenes that have more open spaces, just to feel like haunting in a way. And I think it's deployed very differently in Repo Man, but I mean, look. Like, just look at the end, you know, like how I never seen a green like that floating car, which I think was that actually glow in the dark paint? Is that that's a, the rumor?
Yes, it
that
was before they put on signs on
fantastic.
The headlights.
AI could never.
No.
Love it. Because it still looks like, you know, like for a long time, it's like, how do they do it? Like, is it lighting? Like, what is it? Because it looks tactile, because it is literally a car painted with glow-in-the-dark paint, so that makes sense. But like, it's the absurdity of like, we're gonna paint this entire car. Like, who was doing that? Who, like, they did a whole team of people, or like, what was?
I think it was probably Xander. It was Xander, because in addition to playing Kevin, he was like forced to do PA duties and stuff. So he probably had to paint the car.
What an awesome dude.
Toxic, very toxic paint as well. I imagine we didn't.
I was gonna say it usually is. Yeah. Fantastic.
Keep it away from a flame. You'll be fine.
Yeah, it'll be okay.
For a few days, you're out.
That adds such a dimension to it, too, because Xander kind of spends that whole movie getting, like, thrown into cans or, like, thrown out of his room or, like, pushed down. Like, he is beaten to the pulp by the end of Repo Man, because every scene he's in, everyone, he's the one guy in every friend group that everyone's like, get the fuck away from me. Like, one of the funnier parts of it, when they go into the hospital, and it really starts to feel like a dream at this part of, you know, at this part of the movie, even more than the rest of it, when they're in the hospital, and then he pulls up the sheet to see like who it is under there, because he's looking for Harry Dean Stanton, and it's Xander, and he goes and just puts it back down.
Puts it back, yeah.
You know, Kevin's not dead, because Kevin goes, oh no, you know, and then he puts it, so you know that Kevin's going to survive.
How did you meet Xander Schloss?
Through his sister. His sister, or his half-sister, is a woman called Abby Wall, who was an associate of mine at UCLA. And we worked on each other's films, and I met Xander, who was her brother, through Abby, and also her brother, Dan Wall, who is a composer. So Dan Wall and Xander Schloss are brothers, even though they don't necessarily look very similar.
So my understanding, was he playing music at this time? Because he's not in Circle Jerks at the time, but he was just joined like immediately after. I should know this because I've had Keith Morris on my show, but that's been a while.
Well, when I first met him, he was playing the guitar. First, I went to a house.
Right.
And he was like 15 years old, and he was playing the guitar. So that's what Xander does.
You know, which, well, and did in another one of your movies as well. You know, it makes sense for him to do it. I love that, speaking of Circle Jerks, that Circle Jerks are actually in the movie playing the lounge version of Shit Hits the Fan. You know, it's such a classic, and like, I can't believe I used to like these guys. You know, it's such a classic punk rock hilarity to actually have them do it. You know, Keith is there, you know, should we do Wop Wop, Say What? Like, just like, what is happening? Like, who is this band? And it's like, if you know, you know. And then if you don't, you're just kind of like, that's kind of puzzling. But then, of course, on the soundtrack, they're on that as well, which I actually think that the Repo Man soundtrack is one of the great soundtracks of all moviedom, personally, for my personal sense
of rock and roll related moviedom. Yeah,
it's up there in general. I mean, not as far as composed, but as far as like songs. I mean, look, like I also would say Until the End of the World, Vim Vendors, right? That's a great one as well. You know, Rock and Roll High School. There's plenty of great ones, but the Repo Man soundtrack. Yes, the Repo Man soundtrack was a lot of people's entry foray into punk rock.
And also, even, sampler, you know, the good sampler of the LA scene plus E.
Right. Mm-hmm. Because you didn't just have, you know, I mean, you have, like, first of all, amazing that you got Emilio Estevez quoting Black Flag on the train tracks. Fantastic. No notes. You know, that's always just a wonderful, like, what kind of moment? But you didn't just have like all the known names, but you had like a lot of the working bands that were in there.
The plugs did an enormous amount of music for the film. I mean, they were the composers of the soundtrack as well. Yeah. You
know, right.
From the movie music. Yeah, they were incredible.
And was that their, did you kind of gave them their big break too? Because then they, Tito from the Plugs is now doing a lot of stuff, or has done a lot of stuff with Robert Rodriguez afterwards.
He did quite a bit of acting afterwards, Tito.
Yes.
But the band still exists. And I think, is Stephen Hofstetter in it again? Did they get back together? I think they did.
I should know that, but I don't. Sorry.
I think they did. The Plugs have reformed. And they changed their name to the Cruzados for a while, but I think they may have reformed as the Plugs.
You know, Hombre Secreto, aka Secret Agent Man, is like that. That's an all-timer as far as I'm concerned. But no, like it really is. I feel like for my sensibilities and when I came up, the Repo Man soundtrack is one of those ones that was like, okay, you get, you know, there's a Dead Kennedys tape, there's a Circle Jerks tape, there's a Black Flag tape, so on and so on. Oh, and also here's the Repo Man soundtrack. It's like, what? I've never seen it. It's okay. Just listen to it. Just listen to it. It's awesome. And this is what I was leading to before Andy jumped in and mentioned the Plugs. I love that when Iggy did the post-pop depression tour, a few years back with Josh Homme and Matt Sweeney and all them, that shortly after they kind of convened as a band, like he was like, well, what stuff do you guys want to do from my catalog? And universally, they were like, let's do the Repo Man song. They did it. And it's on, I think, like a live session somewhere. Mm-hmm. And it cooks. And it's awesome. But I guess that was, you know, it was never played live because it was during that time period that
he does it live all the time.
He does it live all the time now. Right. But like for the longest time, he didn't because what was that? That was a Zombie Birdhouse sort of era Iggy Pop, which he was doing other things. That's where I'll leave it.
The guitar player on the recording is Steve Jones of mm-hmm. Sex Pistols. He had just come to Los Angeles and he was such a good guitar player. And so I think the confluence of Iggy and Steve Jones and the other guys who recorded it, they were so good. And they all had so much interesting history. And this recorded it in an evening. It was really amazing. It was like a classic rock and roll song.
Well, like it was Iggy's manager that was sitting watching the film and then said, hey, do you want Iggy to record a song, right? Like that was
we were together. No, Iggy and his manager both came to a screening, so it was with that idea in mind. So neither of them had seen the film. Mm-hmm. They came to a screening in California. Oh. Manager was a guy called Danny Sugarman, who had written a book about Jim Morrison, which I happened to have read.
Nice.
And so I said, oh, Danny, I read your book about Jim Morrison. No, you have. You know, so it got on very well. And Iggy said, yeah, he really enjoyed the screening. And he said, yeah, I'll write you a song.
What was the opening? What was the opening going to be before the Iggy offered to write the song? Like, was there a placeholder song or something in place for that?
No, we didn't think about it until we had the song, and then the song dictated the credits. You know, the song because when the wonderful credit sequence was designed by Bob Dawson, he just cut it to the song, designed it around the song.
Well,
backwards, right? They go the wrong way, which is just kind of unique.
Yeah, the backwards.
It's worth noting.
Which apparently Long Legs did too, right? Yeah. That's what Long Legs apparently did that as well recently. the movie you dare not speak the name of, lest you be asked your opinion of, KT.
We're going to talk about Repo Man way better.
Have you seen the movie called Kiss Me Deadly?
Of course, yes.
Oh, yeah. First episode of the show.
You should see it because that will explain why the credits go backwards. Because at the beginning of Kiss Me Deadly, it's a Mike Hammer tough guy kind of nuclear paranoia thriller. And at the beginning of the film, they're driving along in Mike's sports car before something terrible happens. And you see the credits in the lights of the car on the highway. And so the credits run backwards. It says, instead of saying Kiss Me Deadly, it says Deadly Kiss Me. Very interesting.
So the first episode of this podcast that we ever did was Kiss Me Deadly. That was the first. And then we went backwards and like a few episodes in, I think it's episode 4 or something, we did Repo Man because we had done
Kiss Me Deadly. I think during the episode, or at least maybe if not afterwards, I said that there's a lot of parallels between the two movies in that they pair up very nicely together.
Yeah, well, it's that. I mean,
nobody listened because nobody watched that episode, Andy, and also those early episodes are very bad. So don't.
They are terrible. But I think that piece of that one little moment
that minutia is good. Yes, good minutia. What I was actually building towards with all that, Alex, is that the Iggy bringing the Repo Man song back into the live set, so on and so on, is the cultural cachet of the movie amongst. As like a punk rock identity or whatever has taken the place of punk rock, et cetera, et cetera. Is that a surprise at all to you? I mean, it has to be something that we haven't even talked about your new project yet. We spent most of the 40 minutes talking about Repo Man, and it seems like that happens a lot. So we don't want to be taxing on you, but it really touches people, and really people really respond to it even now.
Well, that's not anything to complain about, is it? That's
But you have made a lot of other movies. I mean, we actually did an episode on Sid and Nancy. We haven't even mentioned that once.
Haven't mentioned Highway Patrolman.
But it's yeah. But this is all old stuff. Let's just talk about the new film because that's at least something that I haven't talked about so much over the years.
I will say that Forrest did pull in Sid and Nancy the Cy Richardson bit, which is like one of the best.
I saw that little clip. Yeah, that was nice. Cy's a very good actor. I'm still waiting to hear if Cy will be in the new film or not. I've sent him the script.
Really? So
you've been acting.
So you reached a couple stretch goals. I was saying you've reached a couple of your stretch goals, right? There's going to be a Phil Tippett sequence. Everybody, we celebrate Phil Tippett and all practical effects on this show.
There'll be a sequence designed by Phil Tippett, a flashback in which the hero, as a little boy, is abandoned by his father outside an orphanage in a snowstorm. Very sad.
And you're going to be using the filming location for a couple of those classic Leone westerns, right? Like The Good Man, the Ugly.
Not for the orphanage scene in the snow.
Not for the orphanage, no.
we are using one of the locations that Leone built for a few dollars more, the location where the bank robbery took place. And also, just across the desert from that, we're shooting in a place called El Condor, which is like a broken down old Mexican fort.
Right,
and that and a lot of time spent in the canyons is our Spanish element. Then we go to Arizona and we shoot in the Saguaro Desert and in a western town called Mezcal, which is about 40 miles east of Tucson.
Yeah, beautiful area.
We're going to Tombstone or Bisbee, or more like
Bisbee is very close. And a lot of people don't realize that the Saguaro Desert is not, like, people think of the entire Southwest as being the Saguaro Desert. It isn't. Like, when you think of that classic, like, Looney Tunes, like, desert, whatever, that's a very specific area. And it is not as big as people think.
At a certain point in Arizona and goes down to Mexico and Sonora. And there are other places in Mexico where they've got saguaro cactus. But everybody thinks it's Arizona,
Right, it's not the whole thing, definitely. Not to say there aren't beautiful areas. I will say you're almost to your fourth stretch goal within the Kickstarter. Which is fantastic. So not only are you advertising more horses, more extras, and better camera gear, which is lovely, but you're involving Richard Beggs. Now, one of my favorite movies of all time is Children of Men.
Oh, yes, it's a wonderful
movie. I'm actually wearing a Children of Men t-shirt underneath all of this other clothing. And one of the reasons why it's one of my favorites is because sound-wise, it is absolutely impeccable. Like, it's astounding. There's nothing like it. And that guy, you know, what, Apocalypse Now? He's done so many amazing movies over the years. Even where it's like, oh, yeah, I don't really care for that movie. But boy, did it sound good.
he has an amazing career. He was the mixer on Repo Man. He was a sound designer on Walker and Three Businessmen, Searchers 2.0. Yeah, and many, many other films of considerable note.
Have you found that, because I noticed amongst the rewards, and again, we have a link for it in the show notes, we'll link for it in the comment section, et cetera, but the different rewards levels, you have one reward level for people to get a stream of the film when completed, but there's also one for physical media. There's one to get, like, a physical copy of the movie so that these streaming services can't yank it out from under you or at a moment's notice, which, you know, everyone's renting their stuff anyway.
Interestingly, that reward is like about twice as popular as the streaming option. So I think there are still people out there, you know, who actually want to possess the physical medium because they don't want it to go away. They don't want it to disappear and not be able to find it on the internet and all of that. But that's actually very encouraging, isn't it? People still want
it's very encouraging because then you have a chance for the extras too. Because one of my favorite, the boon that is the Criterion Channel to me isn't just the films, but to have, you know, there's the commentary, there's the extra interviews, there's just like attendant material. This is what the trailer looked like, things along those lines. Which I did notice this afternoon, actually, Alex, that there's going to be a Repo Man Criterion Collection edition coming out in September.
Well, they've done another reissued. They've done another transfer. That's what you just keep doing transfers. Keep up, you know, upping the number of megapixels in the transfer. So they've done a whole HD 4K transfer from the original negative. And that is coming out very shortly, I think.
You'll be able to see every detail of Otto's earring. It's going to be amazing.
No, it's literally at some point with the transfer or whatever, when they open the trunk, you're going to get...
You know, you're actually going to get burned, yeah.
That's your skeleton. It's like, wow, this TV is feeling kind of hot. I don't...
Do they consult you for these kinds of things, Alex? Because I know that there is the Criterion already has a Walker, and there's like another one of your films that's in the collection. Do they consult you for these, or they just do them and be like, "Hey, it's out"?
I saw this version of Repo Man. I think that I approved of the release of Walker as well. I think I saw that version of Walker.
Yeah, that one's good.
The Sid and Nancy was watched by Roger Deakins, the cinematographer, not by me.
Oh, that's right. Deakins did do that one. Yeah. Yeah. Another cool looking movie that does like, it's practically black and white by the end of it. You know, like it's.
Oh, that was the idea. Like, so that was the idea. Yeah. That's what we're trying to work towards, you know, to have it be increasingly monochromatic if they descend into that thing.
So we have other of your movies that we do want to talk about, but I want to mention that this is more or less, I mean, you're going back to like the Western theme.
This is the one to talk about. This is the one to talk about because this is a Western version of a book by Gogol called Dead Souls. And the book is great. I mean, the book is really funny in a way, but it's also really tragic and terrible, the stuff that's happening. So it's most enjoyable thing to be working on. I've worked on the script with a man called Gianni Garco, who was a star of Italian Westerns. And he played the character of Sartana in a series of Italian Westerns back in the 60s and 70s.
Wait, you've co-wrote it with Gianni Garco?
Yeah, so Gianni and I co-wrote it. I wrote the draft and I gave it to him, and he made so many changes on it that that we ended up sharing the credit. So he is my co-pilot in the screenplay.
I'm super curious.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry, I wanted to say, because I know the story. I'm a Russian lit major, and I think it's really interesting to try and approach Gogol where you're going to hit the comedy and the darkness at the same time, because it doesn't always translate across that cultural barrier. Was that a difficult thing in the script? I'm fascinated by that.
It's really interesting because what the material that the adapter has to work with is the original book and also fragments of the second volume. And what I read about the writing of the book and about Gogol was that he was planning to make a trilogy. This was the first part of the Dead Soul trilogy. And this was the one that was all about bad people. Book two was going to be all about good people. And book three was going to be about heaven. And I don't think he ever even wrote a word of book three, but he spent the rest of his life, didn't he? Like revising book two and tearing it up and burning it. And there are just
and burning fragments. Continually burning so much.
Yeah, he would constantly burn up everything he'd written and start again. And there are just these little fragments of book two, including the scene at the orphanage where his father abandons him. And that explains a lot about Chichikov, you know, why he's so messed up. Except in the book, in the first book, he isn't so messed up. He's really quite jolly about it all. Quite a hard charger, isn't he?
Right.
Yeah.
Cool. I think in our Western version, he's a bit more desperate.
I've noticed
the last movie you did before this was Tombstone Rashomon, right? The Western adaptation of like a Rashomon type story, which is kind of
I loved like the opening title card just starts off with saying that it's a documentary film crew goes back to Tombstone to document it. And arrive a day late. And I saw that just burst out laughing. I thought that was hilarious. And I was like hooked.
And that's the conceit. We have to have that conceit because all these characters are giving interviews. They're giving, you know, against that piece of gray fabric that they hang behind people in documentaries. And, and so we interviewed Doc Holliday and Wyatt Earp and the guy that owned the bar and Kate and all these other characters about what happened, and everybody tells a different story.
You have a lot of different rewards in here. I find it notable that one of them was you can have your name on a gravestone in the movie, and that like that got to the point that there was too many people went in on that one, so you had to stop that one.
That was my fucking reward. Yeah, we had to stop. We sold 50 gravestones, and then you know 10 more people wanted gravestones, and so. But then the art department just becomes like the grave department, you know, the cemetery department.
Exactly.
Well, it's not a Civil War movie, so there's not space for every single grave. Like, I feel like, you know, just
I'm trying to feed as many crosses into that cemetery as possible. You know, it's
going to be. Did you? How difficult was it to come up with these different rewards levels and things like that? Because you've used crowdfunding in the past. There is a bit of a science to it about what works and what doesn't.
You just make it up, you know. I mean, it's just like, you know, some people are going to want to stream the picture. And,
right.
And so you think, well, what value can that have? You know, assuming that there are people who actually want to support the thing as well.
Right.
And then, you know, some people are going to want a DVD or a Blu-ray, which is obviously more work. Because you have to
sensible people, right? Exactly.
For the box so it's all additional post-production labor. But you can set a higher value for the DVD or the Blu-ray because they're a physical good that will last forever. You know, and then it gets signed, and then if it's signed, you pay a little bit more. You know, and so and then you write the picture. You know, the executive producers.
in the film world, right? Like, I feel like there's a tangible value, like the film fan world, obviously, not like the filmmaker world. There's like a tangible value to saying you saw something first. Like, even if it's released just months later on, like, you know, on streaming services or on, you know, on Tubi or whatever the, you know, the thing is, like, there's some value in being like, oh, I saw that movie first. Like, I gave the money and, you know, I was able to screen that movie first.
I was first to the post with the letterbox review. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's
you didn't see it. You got a screener.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Because I'm fancy like that. Right. Yeah. It's, I think there's, so there's going to be some extras included with the physical release of the new film, Alex.
Oh yeah, again. Yeah, yeah, has to be because it's essential. I mean, people expect something. You can't just put the film on the DVD. You've got to have some other stuff. You got to have a making of, and you know, maybe a trailer, and ideally a little booklet. You know,
that's
good, really.
As a musician, it's one of the reasons why I'm happy vinyls made a comeback, because you get to have, you know, the booklet that has the liner notes and has like, okay, here's the lyrics, here's like the recording information, all that stuff. And the fact that that has just been, you know, zipped away from movies, not to mention how easy would it be to have commentary tracks on these streamers, right? It's as you already have, set up for other language files.
You really could. It would just be like having closed captions or something. Just be
another right, audio. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. You could do that. Excuse me, I'm wandering around looking for the plug for this.
That's fine. I think we got a couple super chats, which are paid comments from the audience anyway. So we can, Forrest, if you want to use this opportunity to throw those up. Not that I'm going to tell you what to do, but
it's in the it's okay.
They're all from Thomas Jerome Newton, but I'll do them all one by one. So the first one is Pop, Christine F., especially the station to station.
Referencing here the film Christiane S., for which music. And I guess Station to Station in that. I don't remember that.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know, I don't think I saw the film Christiane S., but of course I'm familiar with
it. She like gets addicted to heroin. It's a bummer.
Yeah, that's why I didn't want to watch it, because I did that Sid and Nancy movie, and that was enough.
I already got one of those.
Yeah, I don't want to sit around watching The Man with the Golden Arm, you know, because I already did a film.
Yes. Forrest got yelled at by the host of Real People when we covered that movie. It was great. Resident Chilean here. Thoughts on Raul Ruiz, Mr. Cox?
No, not really. Nothing. I'm sorry to say, I don't have. I think I've seen a film by Raul Ruiz. What are some of his films? You know, I'll be able to tell you if I've seen them.
Let's see. I'll get our top researchers on that. Let's see.
Everybody goes to IMDb and start typing in Raul Ruiz.
I barely know the guy. I mean, I know that he did.
I can't think if I've seen the film by him.
Socialist Realism, which came out like last year, is the only one I can think of. Yeah. But that's
Three Crowns of the Sailor, Wandering Soap Opera, Mysteries of Lisbon, and Genealogies of a Crime are his top four on IMDb.
All right, and then
I've got it.
It's Raul Ruiz now. He's actually calling to tell you about what movies he did.
Like you're gonna say that it's not my movie that.
right.
Literally 5 minutes. I'll call you right back. All right, man. I'll speak to you. Bye.
City of Pirates is his most popular on Letterboxd. So there you go. Yeah, I don't know. I just don't know him. That's I'll put him on the watch list. I don't know him at all. What else? Is that it? Can we move on? Okay.
Andrew might like this. Any wishes to work in comics? You did work in comics, right?
Look what I've got here right now.
World of Steve Ditko.
I love that book.
Fantastic.
Yeah, that's a great book.
Let me see. And this is the storyboard that I have been working on today for the film in Spain, because we have to build the cemetery.
Awesome.
Look at that.
Lots of us breathing in.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and then their fate.
That's a storyboard.
Here's a storyboard for where the boy is abandoned in the snow. It's a bit like in Citizen Kane, you know, with the sled.
Sure.
The kid gets dumped in the snow by his cruel father. Using my handful of coins, there is the old boy, and father throws his luggage in the snow afterwards, and our protagonist trudges towards the orphanage.
Love it. I feel like if you hit a certain point on the Kickstarter, people would probably love to have like a copy of the actual storyboards. Like, I feel like that could be
original art.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Not really all going to be storyboarded, but I'm just doing this for the designer in Spain and for Phil Tippett, because there's specific scenes. The designer in Spain wants to know how much of this old wrecked fort he has to restore. Because we're going, no, don't spend too much money. You know, well, what am I going to see? So I did the storyboard for him for that, and also for the graveyard, saying we need how many crosses are we going to see. Because the crosses, right. If you only squeeze in 30 crosses, then we're going to have to like take the boards off the crosses and put 30 more cross pieces on them with other people's names.
Or find a second graveyard and try to work a scene in there. Where you're like, oh, right. Wow, we're at a different graveyard.
Sure did kill a lot of people in this town. Speaking of Phil, can I just ask real quick? I know for a fact, because I've seen Mad God, that you know that movie as well, and yes, it delighted me to no end to find out that you were in it, because of course it is classic Phil Tippett. It's stop motion animation. How was that? Did you have any idea of like what it was he was putting together at the time, or like I could see that being meticulously storyboarded or no storyboard whatsoever.
It was a storyboard within his mind. You know, it was originally done as a Kickstarter, but he'd been working for a 20-minute film, but he had been working on it for years before that, doing all the stop motion. And then the Kickstarter came through, and he got $100,000, I think, which was like really impressive. You know, this is like 50 years ago, and he did almost half an hour, and then he did another half an hour. And then he got some more money and he did another half an hour. So he turned it actually into a feature. And I was in the third segment when the humans appeared, when the nurse, when the guy in the high castle.
I love that. There is no movie like Mad God, period, in statement.
Yeah.
True. He made a real one on that one.
Yes.
Real quick, we have one more super chat from Tom Strome. He wanted to know if that was supposed to have been Susie instead of Nancy.
Susie Sue? Is that Susie Sue?
That's her. That's her legal name. I don't. It's okay. But
yeah.
You have to use government names in our chat. Apparently, I don't know. Sorry.
Yeah. Maybe it's a chili law.
In the performance, that woman had a ponytail, and so we had to keep hiding the ponytail. I don't know if we successfully concealed it every time.
That's fun. That's amazing.
Anyway, listen, I've really enjoyed chatting with you, but I have to call that gentleman back.
Can you do five more minutes?
We have a bit that in this case it's catered directly for you. This is a bit that we do weekly, but this is Letterboxd is I've mentioned a couple times, it's a social media site for film lovers to kind of talk out with and to each other about the movies they love, maybe the movies that they didn't love, but. We collect these, and we, in this case is me, collect these funny reviews, people attempting to be funny, hopefully not, that are poignant, incisive, interesting, weird, about the movies in question that we cover, because it's usually focused on one movie. So in your honor, Alex, I collected Letterboxd one-liners for Repo Man that we put on screen and we talk at, make fun of, opine about, et cetera, et cetera. So these are Letterboxd one-liners for Repo Man. Cop turns to ash.mp4.
right in the beginning.
Right in the beginning. It's right there. There's so many great one-liners in this, but my fave is a lot of straight guys like to watch their buddies fuck. I know I do.
It's the immediate, like, because John Wayne said it. Or, you know, like, hypothetically, right? Because it's John Wayne. They just jump right on it.
Right. Absolutely. I too would leave my girlfriend to get in a glowing flying car with my weird mechanic friend.
Who can't drive?
It's very realistic. She just met. They just met. Go to space. It's way more interesting.
Yeah, space is way more interesting.
The child tortured him.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. I don't want no commies in my car or Christians. Again, I called that out earlier, but great line.
Yeah.
Don't know why they made movies after this. They put all the cool shit in this one.
True.
Why there said that? Well, that's obviously supposed to be a case of discernment.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, we speak his name. I started riding the bus for obvious reasons.
Yeah, because, you know, the more you drive, the less intelligent you are. That's why I personally am also with the last name Miller, and I don't drive, you know? Like...
I love when you can tell that every day of filming on set was dangerous. Alex, can you confirm that or deny?
No, I think it was all very dangerous. I think that only in our minds were we dangerous. I think in reality, for the most part, I think it was fairly contained.
Hey guys, I gotta go. I'm really enjoying what we seeing these comments. It's terribly kind of you, but I must go.
Alex, thank you so much for being on the show, man.
Thanks so much, Alex. Thanks
for having me.
Thank you so much.
Good luck with the show.
Be well.
Good luck with the movie.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We'll put that link in the comments again for that too.
Yeah. How do we...
There he goes. Alex Cox, everybody. That was great. Yeah.
What a blessing on us to chat.
The last two.
This honestly should have been the same amount of hype as the Bible. There you go. Fishman Dracula.
People treat it that way. Absolutely. Yeah.
This was my favorite one. I wish you got to have seen this one. It isn't a true punk film unless it shows open contempt towards other punks. Yes. Yes, 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 yes. Can confirm. Those are the Letterboxd.
Part of Catterwall.
Those are the Letterboxd one-liners for Repo Man in honor of Mr. Alex Cox. Please follow at Movie Night Extra, our Letterboxd HQ account, where we're chiming in, opining about all the movies that we cover and every other thing that comes down the pike. You can also follow the Movie Podcaster Code at Always Flacco over there, who is logging all the stuff that we cover on here as well from his own personal sensibility. And you can follow him.
And
to see
usually
that.
Now, like, at least like four extra things every time we do one.
That are like ancillary materials. Yeah, absolutely. of course, I'm at Conan Neutron, ordinary fucking people. I'm watching all the highbrow, midbrow, populist fare. So, you know, you can follow me along for the Criterion Challenge, film school dropouts, all that kind of stuff. I'm back on all of that BS, and I am doing all of it on Letterboxd as well. Professional skull toucher, of course. Andy World over there, at right about now, too, is on Letterboxd watching all the weirdest stuff so you don't have to, or maybe so you can. It is not for me to say one way or the other. Call in balls and strikes, just like a Supreme Court justice. are you still doing Doctor Who episodes? What do you got? Answer quickly.
Yeah, I'm taking a little bit of a break at Doctor Who.
Appreciate the update.
but I'm going to be back on the first Doctor. So, thank
God. All right.
Yeah. Coming back with Doctor What? Doctor What is his next one?
No, actually, I was going for Dr. Katz, professional therapist.
All right. I really.
I love that show. Do it. Do it.
is that on Letterboxd?
No.
All right.
Comedy Central in 1990. That's what it was on. Go back in time.
JG, I want to say you have a Letterboxd account, but I never see you using it, so I don't know if that's true or not. Is that true?
I think I started one and then I just fell behind I'm always too busy and I always mixed up.
You're on the Christina plan. You do it when you want to.
Yeah, I want to.
Too busy is. All right, I'm not going to go there.
During the plugs, I want to ask you about the Jacob Silverman interview you released today.
Which we will get to once I exit this bit. At Movie Runtime, KT Baldessaro. Yeah. She is on Letterboxd, and it is all the stuff that she does on her show and lots more. Let's hit it with the plugs.
If you're watching us on YouTube, please like and subscribe. And then hit the bell to get notified whenever we're streaming. And we'd humbly request that you watch the video to the end because it helps us with the algorithm and helps more film fans to discover the show. We're also monetized. If you want to get your chat questions definitely read on stream, you can always send us a super chat, which will help us keep the show going. Every cent helps. If you're watching on Twitch, you can gift us a free sub on Amazon Prime with your Prime membership, but getting subs on Twitch is always appreciated. And it helps to follow us on there as well. We also have an audio feed, which is available wherever you download podcasts, if you prefer to listen to podcasts rather than watch the stream. That's updated usually the same day we stream, but watching on YouTube and Twitch is the best way to get the show first, live as it happens. If you want to support us with a monthly donation and get access to all of our after parties forever, which go patron only after we do them, you can become a patron at patreon.com/movienightextra. Link is in the description for that. It really helps us keep the show going since we do have some expenses to make this happen. We also have a Discord community. Link is in the description for that. We sometimes watch movies we cover on there. We get into conversations about everything from film to TV shows to related podcasts. We even have a Discord channel for memes. It's really fun on there. You can find us on all the social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, Twitter, and Threads. You connect with us on all of those. Talk to us. We'd love to hear from you. Lastly, we recently made a TikTok at Movie Night Extra, where we're putting up short-form clips from the episodes. Okay, passing this to Conan so he can tell you about his music and this week's Protonic Reversal. Conan, who's on Protonic this week?
Steve Bartek of Oingo Boingo. He has returned once more. I said it was going to be a two-part episode, and I did the first part in January, so I was not lying. It just took me a while to actually do it. We talked at length about a lot of things, not the least of which includes, we talked about some of his work with John Bryan, like in Lady Bird and things along those lines, stuff that we covered on this actual show, a lot of composition stuff. So he is an awesome fella, and it was an awesome episode. You can find that in all the different places. Patreon.com/Protonic Reversal, $1 per month for advance access to the episodes, if you feel so inclined. Conan Neutron and Secret Friends is the name of my band. Neutronfriends.bandcamp.com. You can buy records, CDs. You can buy whatever t-shirts are left. I don't even know what's left at this point. And you can stream it all the places where we don't see any money, too, if you feel so inclined. So go ahead and do all that. This is different. Now, I don't know what I'm just going to final thoughts now.
I mean, everybody else on the stream has to, you know.
Oh, yeah, okay. I was specifically called out, so I've
yeah. do you have anything you want to plug?
You know what? Honestly, if you're following me on TikTok at Movie Runtime, right over there. Nope, it's there. Nope, still there. Fuck it. Sorry. Anyway, three times is wrong. I'm not doing it a fourth. Or if you go find me, Little Deadly Creature, on Instagram, you're going to know what I'm doing and the things that I'm in and the stuff that is current. I'm doing a cute MPAA history fact thing that you can catch some minute and a half facts about film history in the U.S. But just find me on social media. You'll get all you need.
For sure. JG? Anything to plug? I saw that you interviewed Jacob Silverman.
I did interview. Well, I did. Yesterday was Ben Burgess. Today was Jacob Silverman. Later this week, I have some movie-related ones coming out on Parallax Views. First up with Spencer from the Damned Fool Idealistic Crusader channel on YouTube. He talks about physical media and problems with 4K and UHD releases and how AI processing is messing these things up. So that'll be interesting. And I just did an interview with Jared Stearns, the biographer of Marilyn Chambers. He wrote a book called Pure, The Sexual Revolutions of Marilyn Chambers. And of course, she went from adult film to being in David Cronenberg's movie Rabid, you know, which is one of my favorite horror movies that Cronenberg did back in his body horror phase. So those two movie-related episodes should be out, if not this weekend, then, you know, sometime next week. And people can support me on Patreon at Parallax Views. And I really need that support right now because my sole advertiser has shut down his website and I'm without an advertiser right now. So Patreon.com/Parallax Views.
I feel that struggle, but, you know, without an advertiser struggle right now. You know, if anyone has any companies, JG, hit him up, you know, sponsor him. Andy, do you have anything to plug? Things that require you to keep your shirt on, please.
Yeah,
you
know, no, last night we had a great interview with the director of a Al Jazeera documentary. It's a heartrending movie about just like what life is like in Gaza. I'm not going to tell you it's uplifting. I'm not going to tell you it's happy, but it's a wonderful conversation. And it was really nice to actually, hear what she had to say about everything.
Yeah. I can't remember the name of it, but I think I've seen.
Yeah, The Night Won't End.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the one. I guess going around for final thoughts, that was the quick plugs, right? You know?
Yeah, I mean it's not really about one thing, so that's kind of a break in format, isn't it?
Yeah.
KT, do you have any final thoughts on any of this?
Just thank you guys for letting me join in at the last minute. I know Christina wasn't able to come, so I really appreciate the invitation to just be able to hear, sit and listen to Alex talk. It really was quite an honor. And I'm so fascinated about the adaptation of that kind of source material into I'm going to go give that man some money right now. That's my
Everybody
final
should.
Thought.
There you go. That should be everyone's.
Maybe he'll cast you without you know, if you find a way, yeah. Like you might be able to be like an extra or something.
Yeah,
without,
yeah. Just like, you know, like type in, hey, what donation level can I be in the movie?
Well, no, there is one.
My name is only a lot. It's only two letters. It'll fit on a gravestone
and a headstone. Yeah, yeah.
with a picture of your you know, your headshot or whatever. JG, do you have some?
Because this is like the third or fourth time I've been in an interview with Alex or a show with Alex.
All right.
I always have like
These pants, they aren't big enough for the crotch. Yeah, we get it. We get it. We understand.
I just have a million questions for him though. He's such a font of knowledge. Like this whole time I was thinking to myself, I got to ask him about Peckinpah because of that new Criterion release of Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, because sure. Peckinpah's a huge influence on him. I want to ask him about working with Alex de Iglesias. He was in the movie The Oxford Murders. He's actually an actor in it, because people forget Alex does acting too. There's just so many things I always want to ask him, and there's never enough time because he's a really busy dude.
It's crazy.
But
that he's written
talking
like,
to him.
Yeah,
it's crazy. And he's written like 9 books. Like, I didn't even have the intro would have gone on forever, but there's like 9 books on the list of books that he's written within the last 20 years or something. It's like, Jesus Christ, dude, when do you sleep? Maybe a Repo Man takes speed for all I know. I don't know, but just
you
got to
do an episode on Highway Patrolman at some point.
Yeah,
it's one of his lesser known movies, but it got a Blu-ray recently from I think Kino Lorber
with a gorgeous painting on the cover.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But Andy, final thoughts?
Yeah. Oh man, it was so cool. I still had so many questions because we never even got into how he met Cy Richardson. Because I just watched Searchers 2.0 last night, and honestly, Cy's appearance in that is just amazing. So and also he actually wrote "Fucka" John Wayne. It was such a great scene. But,
it's kind of like it's crazy that we have so many questions about like his old stuff, and like during it he was hinting like that's my old stuff. Let's talk about my new stuff. But it's like but there's so many questions about your old stuff.
Hard relatable for me, by the way. When I'm the subject of interviews, it's always that way. People want to talk about stuff from ancient history.
I gotta be honest, I was surprised when he said that I didn't realize that he was co-writing Dead Souls with Johnny Garko, because Garko, for people that don't know, is like that dude is like a legend of the spaghetti
Sartana,
western, right
man.
Next to right next
there's,
to
there's like
Tony
15
Nero.
Of those movies.
Yeah, and I think he's hoping to cast
my favorite is Sartana's here. Trade your pistol for a coffin.
I think Gianni is going to be in the movie too, as well as co-writing it.
That's
so hopefully
amazing.
That happens.
Although they retitled it to the far and inferior A Fistful of Lead, but yeah,
A Fistful of Lead.
But yeah, I am Sartana, your angel of death. That's a good one. Have a good funeral, my friend. Sartana will pay. Light the fuse. Like, Sartana is coming. Yeah, great.
With like runaway success of the Sergio Leone movies, there's so many movies now that are A Fistful of Blank that are like
It was shameless.
I guarantee you, before that, nobody ever had a fistful of anything. But like that movie came out, they're like, oh, it's a fistful of it's a fistful of rubbers. We got a
fistful of rubbers.
Yeah. But Conan, final thoughts. Yeah,
that's what I have to get us out of is a fistful of rubbers.
I never really did. I finish my final thoughts or even say them.
Yeah, I asked you.
I believe your final thoughts were a fistful of rubbers.
Yeah,
fistful of rubbers in summation.
No, I asked you, and you were talking about how we didn't have a chance to ask about Cy Richardson. And
your final thoughts were whining. Yes.
No. I just wanted to bring up just how great Cy Richardson was. Because honestly, like that dude. Rocks in everything that he's in, and he is so different from film to film. Like, you think you know who the dude is, it'll show up in the next movie, it'll just be like, oh my god, this guy has range. So you know, shout out to Cy Richardson
acting.
My spaghetti western,
he was acting.
My spaghetti western would be called a fistful of spare change. And like, good. Look, I gotta put money in the meter, so you know, but Conan, final thoughts.
somehow that's not much better than Fistful of Rubbers as far as a deficit. Still, but anyway,
yeah,
that was great. I feel like we should be doing that kind of thing more often.
For sure.
Interesting to change up the format in that way. But I think we got in a little bit about, you know, most of his most of the movies people would wanted to hear about, and probably the only podcast he's gone on where we actually talked about Walker at all. Frankly, I don't know. Maybe there's another one.
Yeah. Well, I watched some of his interview with Jason, and Jason, like, he brought up Walker to Jason. He's like, you know, I don't know much about the studio system anymore because I made a film called Walker, but I don't know if Jason was the one that brought any of that up.
Yeah, I don't know. There's probably another one, but I thought it was, you know, it's good. As much as I mean, Repo Man's one of my favorite films, so I'm gonna want to talk about that. But that's what a rare and cool opportunity that is, because it is truly one of the great punk rock movies. And you know, it's, you know, one thing I wanted to say is about that is not only is it a sci-fi movie without having any of the hallmarks of sci-fi, it's also a movie that's more or less about cars. That doesn't feature like all of the hallmarks we think of in movies about cars, where they're talking about cars and looking at engine
auto parts.
Yeah. But like, that is such a small little piece of banal minutia attached to like everything else that, you know, the guy's an interesting character, an interesting guy. This movie's going to happen at this point, but I'm very excited to see it. I think it'll be real.
I mean,
cool.
They found a way to make a movie about cars centered around people that don't really give a fuck besides the fact that they have to repossess them.
But right? They repossess them. And it does such a good job with that. And it's when the only... Again, there's such an endemic car fetishism in Western culture that it is really funny that like it's not there at all. There's like just like again like the it's the MacGuffin. It's the token that you have to grab to get the cash, right? And it's so great just how lizard brain that is, and how like the actual mechanism of the car and whatnot is not glamorize any way, shape, or form. It's pretty great.
I love the idea of Miller too, as like a guy that works at the car yard that doesn't drive.
Like, fantastic, like, great. Yeah, like. Yeah. It's not what he does. And last thing, just gonna say all time quote: look at those assholes, ordinary fucking people. I hate them.
All right. So the last thing that I wanted to wanted to plug before we finished up. We weren't originally going to stream today. We were going to take a break because next week, starting, you know, for the next couple weeks, we have Mike Maraski, who worked as a sound engineer on Lord of the Rings, coming on. And then we have an episode.
Visual effects and the head of visual effects.
So we have a head of visual effects for Lord of the Rings coming on, and we're going to talk to him about Lord of the Rings. And then we have a second episode on the second with KT and Renee, where we're going to talk even more about Lord of the Rings, because one movie is not, you know, one episode is not enough to talk about all three movies of Lord of the Rings. And this kind of threw a...
Nine hours of movies we have to watch, right? Have to. Yeah.
But threw
I'm looking forward to it.
Really cool wrench into the, you know, into the smoke, because it's like, now this week I have to put that like into a more contained time, but I'm happy.
Well, I thought we were going to be taking the week off so I could more comfortably do that. But hey, if someone asks if you're a god, you say yes. Somebody asks you, want Alex Cox on the show? Yes, we do. Thank you. I will say also Mike Maraski, better known for some people, he's the head of sound design at Valve and does all the music for the Left 4 Dead video games for people that didn't know those. And for someone
I'm happy
myself,
he did something with music, so I wasn't just making that up off the top of my head.
And he's also, of course, the guitarist and singer for Steel Pulse Bathtub, the legendary 90s noise rock band, who are one of my favorite bands of all time. So he doesn't talk about the Lord of the Rings stuff much. But he was excited about coming on the show to do this. So I think that's going to be very interesting. That's my spoiler alert.
That small world. Girl in the Basement executive producer was Ken Birdwell, who worked with him to find Valve Studios.
No kidding. That's awesome. Wow.
Yeah.
It's all connected, sure, people.
He met him at a convention, and he gave us $2,000 to make the movie.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's awesome. There's like so many connections in the world, man. You know, it's like UFOs and time machines.